Pushkin.
Last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? Most people don't think about their space as an Airbnb, but hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I've interviewed many successful people over the years, and one thing I find fascinating is that many of them don't consider themselves business savvy. Take the owners of Tight Knit Brewing. They turn to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards, and do all of it in one place with the Chase mobile app. And that's helped these brew-loving friends turn a passion into a business. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, they're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey, it's Jake. Before we get into this episode, I want to let you know that you can now binge the entire season ad-free by becoming a Pushkin Plus subscriber. You can hear all 6 episodes before they're released to the public. Sign up for Pushkin Plus on the Deep Cover Apple Podcast show page or visit pushkin.fm/plus. Your subscription also unlocks more early and ad-free content from other true crime shows coming later this year, like new seasons of Death of an Artist and Lost Hills, and a brand new true investigation called Where's Dia? Now, onto the episode. Hey, it's Jake here. I just wanted to give you a heads up that this episode contains a detailed account of a hate crime, a murder. Previously, on Deep Cover.
Craig Peterson, you don't know us, but we're here. We want to talk to you, federal agents. Can we approach you? And Craig just looked at us and said, I don't know what you're talking about.
I think he said something like, yeah, we heard rumors about that someone said we did a homicide, but man, that's nothing to it. We didn't do any homicide. It's a bunch of junk.
You can feel the tension, but you can also feel like he's about to say something. And then he says, I'll tell you everything.
So there are Scott Duffy and Terry Mortimer in a conference room at the FBI's offices in Wilmington, Delaware. And they're sitting on the edge of their seats because across the table from them is Craig Peterson, the electrician from Vermont with the spiderweb tattoo. Now, they suspect that Craig was an accomplice to a murder. For months, Craig had been playing it cool, admitting to nothing. But now, in this conference room, Craig has promised to tell them everything.
It was a moment that I think of everything that Terry and I had been through, had prayed through, and this was the moment in time. This was it. It was almost like this is the reason why you were brought together.
Mind you, this moment, it wasn't just the result of good luck. 2 days prior, Scott and Terry had played their best and last card. They had handed Craig a subpoena to appear before a grand jury. They were hoping that this would get him talking. It was a long shot, really. Truth was, the feds had very little on Craig. But Craig, he offered to tell them everything. Before he did, however, he made a request.
He says, I need to have assurances. And we said, what type of assurances? Well, you have a prosecutor on board. Can you call the prosecutor? Absolutely, we can call the prosecutor. But, Greg, you gotta... I can't just call a prosecutor over here and waste his time. You gotta tell us, what is it we're asking the prosecutor to come for? And that's when he says, I'm not the shooter. And I want immunity.
Upon hearing this, Scott's partner, Terry, kind of sat up in his chair.
Now, I'm thinking to myself, this dude's a pretty savvy dude, thinking, like, attorneys talk about immunity. Federal agents talk about immunity. Not electricians from Burlington, Vermont. Like, where did he get that from? But that's what he said. I want immunity.
Now, typically, giving someone immunity is not a quick or easy task, especially in a situation like this, where someone's been murdered. Getting all the higher-ups to sign off can take days or longer. But Scott knew time was of the essence. He needed to jump on this before Craig changed his mind. Fortunately, he had a prosecutor on standby.
Prosecutor dropped everything, ran to my office. We spoke with him briefly, saying, in so many words, he's confessed. And we don't know where to go from here. And so he said, so what you need is immunity. Am I hearing that?
And Scott's like, yeah, that's exactly what Craig is asking for. And the prosecutor is like, I think I can help you guys. But first, the prosecutor had one crucial question, and he wanted to ask it directly to Craig. So he hurries over to the conference room.
And the first thing the prosecutor asked him, very first thing, are you the shooter? If it comes back at all in any way that you pulled the trigger, deals off. No immunity, nothing.
Craig tells them, no, I didn't pull the trigger. Wasn't me. The prosecutor seems satisfied. He whips out a pen and begins to write out a grant of federal immunity.
I'm looking at Scott and going, this is unbelievable. That never happens.
But that's exactly what happened.
So with that, Craig tells us that he starts, the dam breaks.
Up until now, Scott and Terry have been going on a prayer, quite literally, chasing down rumors and nothing more. But that was about to change. A confession was at hand, one that would validate Scott and Terry's hope that they were uncovering something they were destined to find. Ultimately, this confession would upend many people's lives. It would transform a whispered rumor into a full-blown murder investigation. And maybe, just maybe, it could lead them to the victim. I'm Jake Halpern, and this is Deep Cover, Season 4, The Nameless Man. Episode 2, The Confession.
Last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. Our Airbnb even had a balcony that overlooked the Colosseum. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? You could just host a spare extra room, or you could Airbnb your whole home while you're away to earn some extra money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, hello. Malcolm Gladwell here from Revisionist History. If you've watched a professional tennis match recently, you'll know that fans have this amazing new tool at their disposal. It was created by the consulting company Infosys and the Association of Tennis Professionals. It's an immersive 3D viewing experience for tennis fans, which allows them to watch matches from new angles, get real-time statistics, and better understand the inner workings of the game and its athletes. Basically, a completely new data-driven way to appreciate a tennis match. It's been a huge hit, and I'm proud to say that the Infosys Tennis Platform earned first place in the customer experience category at the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business, an event held at Mobile World Congress in Las Vegas that celebrates customers who've boldly innovated for the sake of meaningful change. And I think it's important to point out that innovation like this doesn't just require a great idea and exploit some great underlying technology. It takes courage. Because tennis is a game with a long history and some pretty powerful traditions. I mean, you can only wear white at Wimbledon. Still, it's the 21st century. And here was an idea that said we can dramatically change the way a fan watches a match. We can feed them data. We can allow them to see things they could never see before with the naked eye, or even conventional camera angles. If you want to turn a world upside down, you have to have a pretty strong backbone. That's a lot of what the T-Mobile for Business Unconventional Awards are all about. Finding people and companies who show that kind of boldness. I encourage you to enter. It's a fantastic event and a great way to be recognized for your brave, outside-the-box thinking in front of the industry's most influential leaders, and an even better way to say, I told you so. You can enter by July 31st at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. That's tmobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank N.A., member FDIC.
After the dam breaks, Craig just starts talking, recounting what he could remember from that night back in 1989, when he and Tom Gibeson were still in high school.
And so he starts telling us how it went down, that basically that he and Tommy decided one night to go and find a black man, to kill that black man so that they could get their spider web tattoos as skinheads.
Craig tells them they borrowed his mother's car, a gray Chevy Beretta. Craig drove, Tom was in the passenger seat. They'd gotten their hands on a gun, a .38 caliber revolver, and they started looking for a target. All of this, by the way, and what I'm about to tell you, is based on Scott and Terry's recollections and the report that they filed at the time, and also from sworn testimony that Scott, Terry, and Craig later provided. Anyway, initially Craig and Tom drove through Wilmington, Delaware, where they lived.
He said it was very busy. He said there were just so many people out, and there would be no way that they would be able to shoot somebody and not have a witness around. So they made the decision to leave Wilmington and travel north.
They drove north on the interstate until they reached Philadelphia. Here they got off at the Broad Street exit. By now it was late. Craig wasn't sure exactly how late, but the streets were mostly empty. Craig said at one point they stopped and stole a license plate to put on his mom's car as an added measure of protection, just in case someone witnessed what they were about to do. At some point, they passed a large wall, and eventually they turned onto a one-way street.
Craig's driving, and they drive down a very dark street, and Tommy is in the passenger side, and he tells Craig, slow down, slow down, slow down.
Because up ahead, they saw a pedestrian, a lone black man. As Craig recounted it, the man turned and started walking toward them.
Tommy pulled out a .38 caliber revolver, leaned out the window, and shot him, and exclaimed, I got him right between the eyes.
the way Craig remembered is the guy hit the ground so hard that he had to be dead.
Craig said that even all these years later, he still remembered the sound of that thud as the man fell onto the pavement. And that was it. These two high school kids, with their gun and their mom's car, sped off into the night, back home to Delaware. So far, this entire investigation had been based on a rumor. A rumor that initially seemed like it might be impossible to verify. That two teenagers drove into a nearby city to murder a complete stranger because of the color of his skin. And that they'd commemorated this murder with a tattoo. It was the kind of story that you didn't want to believe in. Because if it were true, what did that say about us as human beings? About our capacity for hate and cold-bloodedness? In a way, the veracity of this rumor was about more than just one murder. It seemed like a test, a light meter that would measure just how dark the depths of humanity could be. It all hinged on a single question. Could these kids really have done this? And in a situation like this, you almost have to hope, maybe even pray, that the answer is no. Because then the world isn't so bad, right? But if the answer is yes, they really did this, well then, the depths are darker than most of us would care to admit. As Craig recounted the details of the murder in that FBI conference room, Scott listened intently. If you recall, Scott had trained to become a priest. Back then, sometimes people would notice his priest's collar and just start talking, sharing their darkest secrets. So Scott, he was comfortable in this role as the confessor. He knew how to listen, how to watch, which is exactly what he did as Craig spoke.
And when you watch somebody tell the story, you can tell that they are just reliving it, that they were there. It was just amazing to watch, because that's all I'm doing is watching him.
Craig's confession raised so many questions for Scott and Terry. Like, why would Craig, the steadfast sidekick, turn on his old friend now? Because in the past, Craig had been very loyal. Like, a few years back, Craig had tried to protect Tom from the authorities by storing some weapons for him. Weapons that Tom wasn't supposed to have. Craig paid for this, did a few years in prison, in fact. So maybe he was willing to talk now just to avoid a repeat of that. Craig got out of federal prison in 1999. A few years later, he moved north to Vermont, to that house in the mountains with the dogs and the floodlights. Bottom line, it seemed like Craig had made a decision to escape his old life, and maybe to escape Tom too. I should mention, we reached out to both Craig and Tom for this story. Craig declined an interview. We never heard back from Tom. But here's what we can say about Tom. He had a long and well-documented history of violence. As a teenager, he'd been convicted of reckless endangerment after he shot a gun at a moving car full of people. Police records from the time confirmed that Tom had an arsenal of weapons, including a billy club, two blackjacks, two sets of brass knuckles, and a mess of knives. To put it plainly, Tom seemed like the kind of friend that you might not want to anger by turning on him.
We believed that a real danger existed. There is a very real potential of danger against Craig. People will go to great lengths to protect their self-interest.
But at this point, there is no turning back for Craig. More after the break.
Last spring, my friend Stephanie and I had a chance to travel to Rome as part of her research trip. And as usual when I travel, we stayed at an amazing Airbnb. Our Airbnb even had a balcony that overlooked the Colosseum. It was the perfect spot to check out the sights and just relax. But what was happening to my house while I was away? Did you know that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? You could just host a spare extra room, or you could Airbnb your whole home while you're away to earn some extra money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, hello. Malcolm Gladwell here from Revisionist History, my podcast about the overlooked and the misunderstood. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Outliers. It was about exceptional people, the ones who operate at the outer edges of human performance. Outliers fascinate me. And last year, I discovered an outlier in the form of a community organization, Washington State's City of Bellevue. The city wanted to improve public safety by making their roads safer. So they created something that no one had ever built before, a platform that gave road users warnings of any dangers ahead in real time. How did they build it? By using a combination of technologies, the Cellular Vehicle to Everything Network, T-Mobile's 5G network, and 5G-connected cameras. People driving, bicycling, walking, running, can't forget people running, and people operating the transportation network now had a way to prevent crashes. It's been a huge success. The City of Bellevue earned first place in the community category at the T-Mobile for Business Unconventional Awards, an event that celebrates T-Mobile customers who've dared to innovate for the sake of meaningful change. If you're a T-Mobile for Business customer and your team has, like the City of Bellevue, innovated something really, really cool, I encourage you to enter. It's also a great way for Outliers to be recognized in front of your industry's most influential leaders. You can enter at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. That's tmobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handle them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank N.A., member FDIC.
Scott and Terry now had a confession, which, under normal circumstances, would be a very big deal, potentially a game changer. And in some ways, the confession was very promising. Craig recalled some details, like the moment of the actual shooting, vividly, in a way that might be very persuasive for a jury. The problem was, the alleged murder took place more than 17 years prior, and there was so much that Craig did not remember. For instance, he couldn't tell the feds where exactly this happened. He couldn't provide the name of a street or intersection or park, nor could he tell them exactly when this happened. Couldn't offer a day or a week or even a month. Most vexing of all, Craig had no idea who the victim was. And this right here underscored the central problem that Scott and Terry had been facing from the very beginning. Simply put, they didn't have a body. They were trying to solve the murder of an unknown man. And without knowing who he was, they couldn't do much of anything. But Scott remained determined.
We have to do our job. And we have to find out, who did they kill? If it's possible, how are we going to do that? It then felt like a mandate. Like, okay, we're in this.
This sounds awfully confident, but both Scott and Terry told me that they felt, on some level, like they were trying to find a needle in a haystack. They both used that exact phrase, which raises the question, how do you find a needle in a haystack? Well, in theory, you start by sorting through all the pieces of hay, right? In other words, you create a finite pool of possibilities. So let's talk about the finite, the things Craig knew or claimed to know with some certainty. Craig knew the murder took place sometime around the spring of 1989. He remembered this in part because he recalled going to senior prom not long after the murder took place. So, the agents had a year, 1989, and they had a city, Philadelphia. And for whatever it was worth, Craig had mentioned a one-way street and a dark-colored wall. According to police accounts, there were 473 murders in Philadelphia that year. So in theory, one of those murder victims was their nameless man. But which one? Turns out, our federal agents, they had an ace up their sleeve. Scott knew someone he believed could really help them, a detective who worked in the homicide unit of the Philadelphia Police Department, a veteran investigator named Leon Lubieski, went by Luby for short. Scott gave me a very vivid picture of what Luby looked like.
He's a large physical stature. Like when you hear a bear, you think of a bear and, you know, scary or cuddly. I mean, bear has many different views depending on who you ask, right? But nobody will ever deny the fact that a bear is big.
And you can't argue with Scott on that one.
When you saw him, you perked up and you're like, oh, he's not somebody to fool around with.
But apparently, Luby also had this other aspect.
He had the face of someone who was just extremely caring. You just looked at him, you knew immediately, this is somebody who will do anything to help you.
So he was a multifaceted bear.
Multifaceted, cuddly, but he could turn grizzly if he needed to.
Scott's hope was that his old friend Luby, the multifaceted bear, could now help them find the victim.
Hello.
Hey, is this Luby?
It's Luby.
Luby, this is Jake. Is this still a good time to talk to you?
Yeah, it's a good time.
It took me a while to track Luby down. He's retired now. When we spoke, he remembered the case right away.
They had these details, but they didn't actually have a body to go with it.
How unusual is that to have someone say, hey, we're pretty certain there's a murder. We have a confession. We got no body.
That's rather unusual.
Scott had passed along a short list of facts to Luby to help him with his task. They included the following. 1, the area where Craig remembered driving. 2, the type of weapon that was used. 3, the nature of the wound, a single shot to the head. 4, the race of the victim. And 5, a general time frame for when this happened, the spring of 1989.
How optimistic were you that you were going to be able to get them what they needed to solve this?
I was actually very optimistic because we keep pretty good records on our dead bodies.
For Scott and Terry, this was a search for a needle in a haystack. But Luby was an insider who knew how things worked in Philly and knew exactly where to look. As far as the records go, the authorities believed this murder case would have been marked as unsolved. It happened back in 1989, and Luby was getting this request 17 years later, in the spring of 2006.
So what happens with a case when it goes unsolved?
Well, it stays with the assigned detective. And if he gets a chance, he goes out and works on it, in between things. If he doesn't, it just lays there, becomes cold.
Basically, the file just sits there in a file cabinet in the homicide department.
Homicides just want one big room, and there's file cabinets all along the walls. And in those file cabinets are the open cases. And then they move them into storage.
Luby told me that typically, after a few years, the unsolved case files are sent to the city's storage facility, a big 10-story building. The homicide files are kept down in the basement.
And when that happens, the assigned detective, he no longer it's a bit of a problem for him to get to his case file.
Now, so is it kind of a little bit of out of sight, out of mind?
Basically, once it goes in the storage, like the supervisor doesn't bother you anymore to get anything done on it. So it's like in limbo.
As far as I could tell, these cold cases kept down in the basement, kind of like the messages at the very bottom of your inbox that slowly recede from your consciousness and eventually get moved into some folder that you'll most likely never look at again. So when Luby got the call from Scott and Terry, he didn't have the actual case files from 1989 right at his fingertips. What he had was a loose leaf binder, an index of all the murders from the past. This index was a collection of so-called summary sheets.
It's a single page. It's got the deceased name, cause of death, you know, what the outcome is if it's still open, things of that nature.
Luby searches through these summary sheets and narrows the possibilities down to unsolved murders that occurred around the spring, anywhere from January through May. There were 37 of them. Then he weeded out all the ones that didn't match up with the details that Scott had given him. In the end, Luby was left with just one case, an unsolved murder from April 16, 1989, of a 33-year-old black man. He was killed by a single 38 caliber bullet to the head. This happened in North Philadelphia on a one-way street just one block away from an imposing stone wall. Luby made arrangements to get the entire case file pulled out of storage, unearthed from that basement, and then he reached back out to Scott. Luby faxed the summary sheet directly over to the FBI's offices in Wilmington, Delaware. It was an efficient bit of detective work. He'd done all of this in roughly 24 hours. So, you can imagine Scott's reaction when, just a day after getting Craig's confession, a fax arrives from Luby. And Scott, he just holds it in his hands and stares at it.
It was unbelievable feeling that this is it. Seeing the name and seeing the specifics of the crime, having a location, a street. I don't even think I put it down. It was, this is it.
Wait, how could you be so certain?
I don't know. I just felt like everything that Craig told us fit this very crime.
And so much of it did seem to fit, including the time frame, the one-way street, the proximity of the wall, the caliber of the bullet, the single shot to the head. The motive noted on the fax was one word: drugs. Objectively, at this point, you could not say it was a slam dunk. There was no DNA match. No one had found a murder weapon and matched it to a bullet from the scene of the crime. None of that. But even so, Scott remembers turning to his partner, Terry, and saying,
"We have a name. We have a victim. Terry, I think this is why we're here. We believe this is who we've been pursuing." That was pretty powerful to us.
At long last, they had a name. It was right there on the fax, plain to see, printed out in smudgy letters. Aron Wood. They strongly believed that he was the victim. This was a huge moment in their investigation. And yet, it could still amount to nothing. Identifying a potential victim did not guarantee a conviction, or even guarantee that there'd be a trial. Now the question was, would there be enough evidence to bring a case and convince a jury that this is what happened all those years ago?
Terry and I said, it may be that this does not ever go to a court. There may be nothing that we can do or Philadelphia can do, even with Craig's cooperation, that this is ever going to see the inside of a court. And letting Craig know that this all may be just to give Aron Wood's family some sense of understanding.
But a kind of terrible understanding, right?
Yeah, definitely. I just believe having no name, having no understanding of how your loved one's life came to an end, who did it and for what purpose, I think can drive you mad.
As investigators would soon learn, Aron Wood had a family, including a mother and two younger brothers. For 17 years, they'd been searching for answers about how and why he died. The last chapter of Aron's life was like a story that stopped abruptly, mid-page. No explanation, no closure. There had been very little to hold on to. But all of that was about to change. Next time on Deep Cover.
Everybody liked him. That's why we was baffled. Like, oh, somebody shot Aron. Shot Aron? You cat? Nah. No way. And I guess that's what puzzles the most in the beginning. Couldn't figure it out.
Cover is produced by Amy Gaines McQuaid and Jacob Smith. It's edited by Karen Shikurji. Mastering by Jake Gorski. Our show art was designed by Sean Carney. Original scoring and our theme was composed by Luis Guerra. Fact-checking by Arthur Gompertz. Our story consultant was James Foreman Jr. Special thanks to Jerry Williams, Sarah Nix, Greta Cohn, and Jake Flanagan. I'm Jake Halpern.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the unconventional awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
The following is a high-five moment from highfivecasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sort. High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at High Five Casino.
.com. High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country.
So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.